Welcome to the Learning Reinvented podcast, brought to you by myself, James Politilo, and the team from The Learning Effect. There are lots of learning podcasts out there, so we wanted to do something slightly different. In this episode, we'll be taking a look at how technology is and should be used in learning. To share his expertise, experience and views, we are joined by Fred Thompson. Fred, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, James. Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
I really appreciate you joining us today. And just to help our listeners, can you introduce yourself to them and tell them a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, absolutely. No problem. Yeah. So I'm Fred Thompson, the founder and CEO of Thirst. So, you know, Thirst is an AI-driven learning platform. You know, it's designed to give your learning development a boost. You know, you think of it like a turbocharge in your learning culture, you know, finding talent, growing leaders, moving people within your organization. It's got a heavy focus on personalized learning, has the right content for your team, you know, as and when they need it. So that's the product that we founded. But, you know, for my myself and my personal background, I started life as a software developer, you know, and I fell into the L&D space somehow coming out of college, not quite sure how. Built a business in L&D, effectively just supporting organizations building, you know, really bespoke learning management, learning development platforms as well. And then just spotted a gap in the market to sort of build something that was really advantageous using the technology expertise we've got and really making a difference and advancing learning solutions. So yeah, that's kind of a quick synopsis of my background.
But, you know, I think like most people, you've probably fallen into learning and development. Certainly I did something similar a number of years ago, fell into the industry. I know some people are now sort of selecting the industry as a career, which I find a little bit odd. But people are choosing to come in and to do L&D, where I would have had no idea when I was at the start of my career that it even existed.
I'm never quite sure if many people choose their careers and the professions and the sectors. It does seem to be sort of you just sort of know someone at some point in time and then you progress. And then you don't realize that you've got a real knowledge and expertise in it by the time you sort of look back. And I think that's where I've ended up. Unfortunately for me, I don't do any development anymore. My whole software development career is behind me. I have a good understanding of it, but it is solely rooted now in L&D.
And as we've both been around sort of the L&D industry for 20 plus years, can you talk us through what you've seen sort of in the use of technology and learning across that time?
Yeah, I mean, technology's throughout, isn't it, in L&D? I mean, going back to the start of my career, like you just mentioned, two decades, you make me feel really old now, James. I started building out learning content in Macromedia Authorware. That was even prior to Macromedia Flash, which was prior to you know, Adobe even purchasing that product. And even in them early days, sort of going back, like I said, two decades, it really the advancements and the ability that, you know, Macromedia Flash provided to you has been able to be creative and create really interactive and engaging learning content was just something that we hadn't really seen before. So I think, you know, all the way back from there, there's good uses of technology. And then, you know, I was early days in developing adapters to utilize the SCORM frameworks as well. So, you know, SCORM 1.1 and 1.1, I was right at that forefront of connecting, writing the JavaScript adapters to it. So I've seen learning and technology sort of progress. I've seen it really advantageous. There's obviously some fails in there, some use of technology that have not quite worked out, but certainly in the L&D space, I think technology has pushed us forward in many different ways.
And I think there's been so many different things. You know, I put my first bit of learning tech into a business back in, I think it was 2000. And, you know, we were putting in first LMSs and it was part of a horrible big Oracle suite, you know, that at the time we were, you know, it was a bolt on to a big HR system. But again, we were putting content in, we were doing systems training, screen recording, you know, lots of things now that are sort of commonplace and available to everyone. But at the time, we're sort of very cutting edge in terms of things that we were doing back then. But across that 20 years, I've seen lots of different things come in. And as you said, there's some fads and some fails, but, you know, it's always the next big thing and the next revolution and anything that's going to change the world. And, you know, we had SCORM and then, you know, the whole world was going to be changed by Tin Can or XAPI or any of those things. And it's just interesting to watch that evolution and see what we've, have we really transitioned as an industry, or have we just put new tech into similar problems? Because I'm just interested in what's actually changed in how we learn and how we progress and how we develop, rather than just putting new bits of tech in to sort of paper over what were the problems created before. Because, you know, I see things like LXPs sometimes fixing the problem that an LMS created, and then an LMS created a fixed a problem that face-to-face training hadn't quite solved. So, but I'm always interested at, you know, that where the tech's actually helping the business or helping people really learn differently or learn better.
Yeah, I mean, you touched upon one of my greatest bugbears, which is the acronyms that we just love in the L&D space. We always try and invent a new one seemingly every month or so, and there's a new one publicized, and data side doesn't help. But I mean, you touched upon, you know, SCORM, for instance, was advantageous largely for the L&D creator, for the kind of person who was actually curating the content and being able to get that out and push that out to learn. It wasn't really an advantage to the learner particularly. It didn't really provide them with much. And in much the same way that SCORM, you know, the early days of SCORM was very much needed. You couldn't really survive, and you couldn't really transpose content between learning platforms without that SCORM standard. You know, then you talk about tin can and XAPI, as it was later known. It's, for me, that's still oddly a really big failure. You know, if we actually look back at it objectively, you know, still to this day, there's some stats, which is something like 70% of learning platforms still utilize SCORM 1.2, which I think came out in 2000 and whatever it was, 2001 or something along them lines. So that's over two decades ago. Tin can's been out 10 years, but still we're seeing something like 2%, I think it is, of SCORM courses even using that standard. And effectively, it was trying to, we have to be aware of this, I think, going forward as well, and a lot of the tech we're probably progressing into now in the R&D space, that there's a scenario where you can actually build tech for tech's sake and thinking that people do need it and do want it, and actually it's got to be driven by a requirement first and foremost. So the early days of SCORM had that requirement. Later on, it was sort of pushing into sort of more tracking of objectives and trying to allow you to learn from anywhere without that learning platform, and being able to sort of build almost a feed of your progress through learning in a similar sort of way that Facebook was doing at that time. You know, someone shared this, someone's completed this course. But ultimately, it wasn't really, and still oddly isn't really a particular need. And still to this day, when I see progress and SCORM, well, any sort of training content tracked, it only comes down to sort of four or five headline things. It's like, when did they start it? When did they complete it? You know, have they done it? Did they, what score did they get? Have they passed? And also maybe some sort of bookmark functionality. But SCORM will do a lot more than that, even, and did do, you know, 10, 12 years ago, but still no one really needed, or at least the appetite and the stakeholder appetite wasn't there to track much more than that. So I think it's key to think about that when we're going forward, especially the newer tech, that actually we've always got to map that back to, what are we actually trying to achieve and why? And let's not just put technology in for technology's sake. I mean, what do you see, James, from kind of, you know, that scenario of what people track and that level of detail? Do you see that being used, you know, a lot further than that? Or do you see the same sort of things I see in that there's only sort of four or five headline stats that are typically asked for?
I think it really comes down to positioning the learning teams and what learning are trying to do, because at the easiest basis, the easiest things to track are, someone turned up in a classroom, someone clicked on a course and opened it and consumed some content, someone passed a test. You know, there's some sort of outputs, but if we think about what learning's there to do, about keep the organization future-faced, keep us skill ready, keep us able to navigate and keep ahead of our competitors, to open up career opportunities, to inspire, to share innovation, to drive creativity. A lot of those things are solving, as I would say, almost the old attendance problem of going back to school or university or grades or passing. And I think sometimes it's the ethos of the problem we're trying to solve, that we're not applying tech to the right problem. And some of that, I think, is we're stuck with because we've got this legacy that we can't seem to break clear of, you know, originally education was, I stand at the front of the room and impart my knowledge to someone else. I think all we've done is take that and maybe go, I impart that into a SCORM package or into a video that someone else then consumes. And we're still doing some of those other bits around the edges. So But it's hard because, you know, even you coming in and sort of coming into the market with a new product, you can't be too different. You're rocking up and everyone's riding around on a horse and you're driving in a car and no one quite understands it. So it's how do we transition the industry and the consumers and the people who are stakeholders of those people in businesses to start to ask and demand different things so we can develop different products. That's my challenge back to the industry. And I haven't really seen us, if I take a real step back, I don't see us doing anything massively different than when I joined the industry in some ways. If I take that helicopter view, we are still predominantly pushing out content and organizing events.
I do know what you mean on that regard, really, as well, because, you know, like I referred to about the analytics side, you know, our platform has got really advanced analytics in terms of tracking sort of measurement and movement of skills within that period of time and trying to identify sort of analysis in your business of, you know, even products or areas that you need to specialize in or you need to provide more support in or whatever. But then because the learning industry generally is so sort of primarily devoted to the compliance way of doing things, compliance is largely about, well, did you do it? Have you ticked a box? Can you now go on site or whatever that might be? And because of that, the stakeholders tend to be just interested in, you know, the primary of did you do it and have you passed rather than anything else. So I think there's a lot of technology that is trying to push things in the right direction equally, but I think you're right in that you've got this legacy mindset almost as well, and you've got to try and move people slowly into that new world. And I think interesting when we think about new technologies going forward, obviously, AI is a massive one. We all know about this. Every sort of podcast and everything we talk about seems to be dominating conversation at the moment. But I think there's a certain amount of just FOMO to this, like fear of missing out, that there's a panic around it, that I think it's moving so fast, everybody jumps in. I mean, I'm using multiple different products, not necessarily even in the L&D space, and they're all rolling out their own version of an AI solution to something that I didn't know was a problem. And I'm very rarely actually utilizing it, even though it's there now. I'm not finding a use case. And I think that's interesting to think about when we talk about L&D. And again, it was like the SCORM example. We've got to go back to thinking, well, what's the point? What are we solving? We are, you know, objectives based. We need to map that back. And also we've got to be aware of how we react a little bit as humans as well. There was a talk I did a few months ago, which was referencing a Swiss scientist, Konrad Gesner, I think he's called. And he was basically raising the alarm of information overload, saying it'll harm our brains. And, you know, there was just this fear of what it was going to do to civilization. And yet this Swiss scientist, Konrad, was he actually died in 1565. And he was actually talking about the printing press. And he was in panic stations about, you know, the fact that suddenly people could print so much and there's going to be too much information. And I see it again playing out sort of hundreds of years later, that there's this panic around AI and about how it's going to transform everything and people won't have jobs and whatever it's going to do. And I think we've got to bring it back down, put our feet back on the ground and say, we've seen this before. This is how we react. And then objectively look at it and say, you know, how can we use this to benefit whatever sector we're working in this case, L&D. So yeah, I think it's useful. Are you seeing it used, James, on your side? Are you seeing the AI and L&D being used effectively in places?
I think you raise a couple of interesting points. I just want to go back to your point about sort of the printing press and just that journey of knowledge even, and then I'll come to talk to about AI. But if you think, you know, so prior to the printing press, I would have, you know, a book would have had to have been handwritten. So it was very elitist. So knowledge was very elite. The only way I would have been able to get knowledge was talking to you directly. There was no communication. So knowledge couldn't be universal in any way, shape or form. And then we've been through iterations that's created universal knowledge. Alongside underpinning that is probably trust in knowledge. So because knowledge was such a rare commodity, people would sort of trust more that what was in a book must be true. Because if you've taken time to write it out handwritten, there's probably some truth and some effort gone into it. Now I can go into LinkedIn and AI suggests me write a post. I'm like, how lazy is that? You know, what's the point of that content? So there's just this drive to churn out more and more content. And we're also starting to understand from generative AI models, that there may be bias built in, there might be inaccuracies built in, etc. And I think all that's doing is reflecting back to us that we've had this knowledge explosion that we've been trying to manage in different ways, shapes or forms, because, you know, people have been overloaded with knowledge. And I know that's why sort of learning teams have, when I've been with learning teams over the last sort of 20 years, some of the problem is trying to sift out and get the right knowledge to someone at the right time, because that is a problem. You know, people are, they need the incentive to look at something, they need to have context, it needs to be time relevant, and they need to have time to practice. So there's so many things that need to come together to almost create learning. And we're trying to fathom our way through those problems. If I'm seeing how AI is used at the moment, I think it's just as you've said, it's almost, it's a bit of a gimmick, it's a bit of a gizmo, and it's being applied to how can we get AI into our tool? And people are solving problems that, as you said, may not be problems, or maybe a minor problem, or a problem perceived by the creator rather than consumer of that tool. And again, in learning, I'm seeing far more people use it to develop content and to develop knowledge by, you know, go in and write good prompts in to pull together something. And there's some good use cases in HR, you know, you can go in and write interview questions, pull together probably better job descriptions than you did, but they're all a starting point, and it's then that contextual piece that I don't think we've got right at the moment. So I think we're still at that infancy, but just putting in loads of AI over the top of something because everyone else is doing it, or trying to rush AI into your business or into learning without thinking, actually, are we using AI to solve the problems we've never really solved about how do we work out what skills people need? How do we drive people and incentivize them to develop those skills? How do we reshape their roles and the reward mechanisms in organizations so that if someone does develop, they can develop a career or they can have commodity to go elsewhere? Because those are actually a lot of the cultural and social and organizational and structural issues that block learning, because you can put great content out, but without creating the need, the desire and the reward, which are sometimes the bits we don't get right, we're sometimes just making our life easier.
Yeah, I think the points you're making around the generative AI and the quality and accuracy of the content is what is paramount in our sector, because you can't be generating some content thinking you've expedited your process as an L&D manager and ultimately it's telling you the wrong information, because there are real catastrophic consequences to that information if it's wrong. And I think that's why going back down to pinning down the using the technology, but actually making sure we understand what benefits it's given us and why. And if it's not actually giving us that direct benefit at this point in time, it's perhaps a little bit too early for us. What I find interesting, and you talked a little bit around, so there's a lot to learning in terms of not just creating content, there's that engagement to it, that's that kind of interaction. You've got to actually connect with the information and learn from it. And I think going back to right at the start of this conversation where we talked about Macromedia and Adobe Flash, I still, realistically, I don't find that many more tools that are now on today's modern web that are actually as engaging or as easy to create engaging and interactive content as it was back in the day, going back sort of 15, 20 years ago before the plugin was made extinct. And, you know, that's still oddly a challenge that we've now flipped from spending a lot of time creating really nice content that was really interactive and visual and had a lot of time taken into the curation of that, to AI being generating content straight away and with lack of accuracy and isn't engaging. You can sort of read a blog post that's written by AI quite easily and identify it, that it's not a human that's written it at this point in time. So we have got to be really careful, I think, in this sector that we don't just fall into something that actually doesn't benefit us at all.
Yeah, and I think there's lots of challenges around how content are used. And I think we almost need to sometimes step back and think about the debate, because, you know, you often see just the regeneration of evergreen content because it needs to have our branding on or it needs to look different for here. So, you know, that compliance stuff, you know, my business partner Katie will talk about FIRE has not changed since the start dawn of time. You need three things to create it. Yet how many million FIRE courses do we have that add no real value on top of that? So where are we spending our time and effort into creating prettier or more interactive FIRE courses, or actually driving the behavior within an organization to incentivize the removal of risk and the dealing with risks and stuff like that. So I sometimes think we get wrapped up in this stuff. And also, I've seen a danger of sometimes learning, seeing themselves as a knowledge police. And there's a little bit more of that coming back in with AI, because you can't necessarily trust everything, because AI can be the wild west of knowledge. So, you know, in the old days of learning, I used to go out, engage with, you know, subject matter experts, take their stuff in, turn it into pretty content, push it back out to them. And then we sort of had this, you know, push to user generated content. And that's not just social content, but saying, you know, everyone should be able to produce their own content, the subject matter experts. And then, you know, you get 400 page tomes explaining something which probably only needs, you know, a two minute summary for a particular relevant level of person. So there's some bridges that AI could do really effectively in those places of helping, you know, subject matter experts turn their own content into stuff that's more digestible, you know, and those types of things, and being some of the bridge in there. So I can see a real use cases, but, you know, just going down and sitting and going, right, I'm going to ask ChatGPT or whatever tool I'm using to write me a course on this that I know nothing about, and I'm going to push that out to someone and hope. I mean, hopefully no one's doing that.
But that's a recipe for disaster, isn't it, realistically? It was interesting that you're talking about, because my favorite technology sort of in this AI world is not the generative AI in the L&D space. It is along the lines of what we can do with personalization and big data associated in that. And that's a safer line at this point in time, because the content is there, it already exists, it's generally been factually accurate because it's been created or curated by R&D managers or other sources. And then you can start to use the AI tool set of, but instead of generative AI, you can use like the personalization side of this to actually tailor-made that content for the right audiences. So, and you can still then fold in generative AI, but to repurpose existing content. So you talked a little bit before about a job description. For HR, I find this quite useful. I've used that very, very recently in a similar sort of thing. I need to write a job description. And there's so many lists of key responsibilities of a software developer that's out there at the moment. But actually putting that together in your own way takes time. That's where these tools can actually curate something that's used information that already exists that we know to be accurate, repurpose that for a document that makes sense for you, and then add personalization to it. So in our product at the moment, we've got personalization throughout, in terms of, you know, we look at everything you do on the platform, every interaction, whether, you know, you like content, bookmark it, you viewed it, you completed it, whether you comment on it, you know, from that author, from that content source, is it a video, is it 2 minutes in long or 20 seconds, is it a 2 hour course? And we're looking at that, feeding that all into big data, and ultimately it's allowing us to build really small micro content that can form part of larger learning journeys, still achieve the same aim as delivering content to person A and person B, but we might deliver it with person A's journey might be slightly more video based, or might be cut down into smaller segments, might have a more casual tone to it versus somebody else who might have more formal learning approach to it. The aims are the same, the objectives, the learnings are the same, but how the personalization kicks in and that repurposing the content, I think, is some of the strongest things we can use the tech for at this point in time, and does exist and does work quite well in my experience. So have you seen the personalization on your side coming in, James, and working quite effectively?
Yeah, I have. I think, you know, that personalization can drive engagement, can help you repurpose content for different audiences really quickly and easily, which is great, because that used to be massively time consuming. So I think it's having that. And again, sometimes we need to do things really speedily, and even for touching groups that you wouldn't, you know, I've been in the businesses where it just becomes too costly to, you know, do stuff in different languages or to do stuff for different cultures. And I'm starting to see some people do some interesting things, or even accessibility. So to make your content more accessible and stuff, there's some really good use cases to actually make your learning better across the piece that I've seen in spots. And I'm seeing people, you know, some really good examples of where it is being used. But then, as with a lot of stuff, there's a lot of almost happy amateurs. There's people playing around that are thinking I can solve the world, or some views expressed that you're just like, I don't want you to run with that view because I'm just worried about what you're going to create or what you're going to do in terms of, You know, and sometimes they're the jokingly hidden quotes of, well, you can do double the amount of work now because you've got this generative AI. You can just ask everything. And yeah, you can. There's certain amounts of efficiencies, but it doesn't mean you should just be plowing out hundreds of hours of more content or whatever. So I think it's the balance of what problem you're solving, how's that helping your users, and how's it helping your business case or your use case, and that can keep you clean. And then, like you said, how effectively is that working at the moment? Because we can probably all sit there and visualize, you know, our own perfect future as to where the positive AI is helping us to imagine a future that we want it to be. We're not quite there yet on some of these things. So I, you know, some of my naive views are sometimes, if I can say it is possible, I know it'll be possible, but at some point it's just, is it possible today or is it worth doing today? But, you know, having that visual and visionary mindset, you need to be reining it into, like you said, what's possible, what's achievable, and what can the tools do today? Because the promise of tomorrow is something interesting, but we need to know where we are and what we're trying to solve.
Yeah, indeed. I think you, while we can talk about the new technologies and sort of the going forward, and you touched upon this a little bit earlier, I think there's part of our problem in our sector as well is the inability to leave things behind as well. So it's not even if the tools exist and we're fully behind them as a concept, I think still there's a legacy play to this that actually people can't let go a little bit. SCORM is the obvious easiest one that springs to mind. You know, it was built for a very different age than what it is today. You know, we couldn't share content between LMSs, but now you've got interoperability, you've got content sources, you've got API, you've got media access into all these, you can connect into them. It's a very different world. Now, we've still got in our platform, we've built SCORM in there still because it's still a needed thing about, and I really didn't want to, but it was a case of occasionally, and a lot of our customers, they're only coming with, you know, one or two SCORM files. It's not the quantity it was before. But really, if we could just repurpose that, or like you alluded to, there are so many fire safety courses. Can we not find one that, you know, is pretty much the same messaging on LinkedIn Learning or something similar and actually utilize that? We can leave SCORM completely behind and we don't need it at all. There's less obvious ones in my mind that I think we should leave behind. PDF certifications is one that drives me a little bit mad. I find the certifying that you've done something needs to happen. We know there's compliance. You need to sort of say you've done that. But there's still this tendency to want to create a certificate at the end of it that's PDF based and get people to print that out, and that becomes something you do. And I find that odd in this day and age. I mean, we hate sort of promoting to print anything, but this still happens all the time. But also there's this exchange of skills and exchange of, you know, you move on through your careers and you move on through your jobs. That should track with you as part of your record of what you've done in your career and what your skills are. And you shouldn't be trying to take a PDF print out of something with you. You know, there's great solutions out there at the moment. There's things like Credly that'll automatically have you like a store of your own badges and certifications, and you can track that through. You can post that directly to your LinkedIn profile. People can see what skills you've got. So that'd be a really kind of, feels to me really low hanging fruit, but we still see it quite often, the PDF certification has been a requirement.
There's some really interesting organizations out there, you know, you're pushing, and there's some smaller organizations that come in almost with a different mindset. So, you know, thinking about digital certificates and blockchain certificates and the fact that's actually verifiable and there's a whole load of connection behind it, and, you know, reducing fraud, reducing risk, some of those things that are the benefit. Plus, you know, there's digital, if you're using digital certification, it acts as a marketing and promotional tool. There's so much more scope to that it becomes far more viral, and there's whole loads of other benefits to it. There's then this whole thing of transferability and transportability. So, you know, people are moving more from organization to organization, but we still tend to find records and learning and things are stuck in one organization. They don't move to others. So there's whole things around there that's just based on a historic mindset. You talk about printed certificates. There's a whole world of verified paper as well, which rather than go to the digital technology, you can actually have verified paper that you can have a QR code printed on the certificate to verify the certificate is there, and then a bit of paper that's got verification to say that should have been printed on that bit of paper, which is like, it seems like an over engineering to go back to an old solution. So rather than going, well, actually we've got digital certification offered by huge amounts of companies that do this really, really well, really, really accessibly and can be part of your solution, but we haven't embraced that. So I'm completely on board with you that there's some massive low-hanging fruit if you step back and say the problem we're trying to solve is people need to be able to verify. There's a solution here where there's actually some tracking, some accountability. You can't change it, you can't do it yet. You know, are we saying actually the solution is someone just wants something to stick on their wall? Well, you can still put that on your LinkedIn or whatever, or you know, your email signature, etc.
It's much more valuable, isn't it, to the end, to the actual learner, because they can publicize it in a way that's modern today. They can put that out to prospective employers. It's on their social. It makes a lot more sense. Whereas your old school printout, you're trying to put it in your window, wouldn't you, or whatever else. Every time I see a picture of a record of achievement going back from a 1990s school, it always makes me think of that PDF certificate thing that no one ever used at any point. But at that point in time, it was something that was so important. And I feel like that has almost led us a certain way. I mean, I have oddly strong opinions about bizarre things like this. I think as humans, again, we struggle to let things go, and we do things because we think they may. Because we did them sort of growing up. Why are we even bothering teaching people, our kids of today, to write cursively? Because I don't really write. It's not something I do on pen and paper. You need to be able to write. I'm not saying you don't need to write, but a certain style of cursive is something that I find is not as important today as it was previously. What I'd be thinking is almost you could start with people learning how to actually use a keyboard fast enough on a computer, because that's what they will likely be doing. But again, if you bring this up, and this is, I appreciate, an opinionated kind of viewpoint of let's ditch cursive writing, but you know, if you bring this up with people have a problem with it because it's what they did and what they know growing up, and you know, that's, they see it as valuable to their children. But actually, if you think about today in your role today, you very rarely write cursively yourself. So I think going back, the easiest way is, like you just said, is go back to the what are you trying to solve and why, how are we doing that, and what tools are the best uses for it.
And, you know, you touched upon that sort of point of view, you know, you've had to build SCORM into your platform and keep hung to that legacy. And when I look at some of the things that hold the industry back is sometimes that lack of knowledge or that lack of stepping back. And we see it in our role all the time, because we're working with organizations to help them find the right tech or evolve their learning strategy. And one of the things quite often people will lob up with it is lists of requirements. And we'll go down the list of requirements. They've got not a clue what half of them mean, or not a clue as to why they really want them. They've maybe got them off there's a sites you can get them off the internet, you know, which literally list everything, or are based on quite historic or huge multinational companies that have huge levels of complexity. And stepping back and stepping away from that, you can find far better solutions. You can often save yourself loads of money, but people don't take that time. They just rush in. And then you're sat with a client in front of you going, I must have SCORM compliant courses. And no one's ever really challenged that. But the vendor next to that, but the vendor next to you is saying, yes, of course we can, because we'll sell you that. And therefore nothing really changes, because someone's got it in a requirement list. They feel they must have it. There's no real reason for them to have it. And so being able to challenge and move the industry, to me, is about putting some of those holy cows up there and being able to go, let's hold the mirror up to ourselves and go, what are we actually delivering? You know, what do we need to burn? And there's an industry actually challenging some of those things. And I understand why, if you've been running a platform for 10, 15 years, you've got so many customers in there, you've probably got a legacy of all these features that you've got to get knitted together. But, you know, My question to people often is, if you started with a blank slate, which is perfectly possible in most places, you know, you can almost go, let's imagine with a blank slate, what would you design for learning today? Because it really helps people to think about things differently. If you didn't have to do all that stuff, if you didn't have to do compliance in the way you do it, what would you do today?
I'm sure, Fred, answering that question, we could go down a whole series of rabbit holes. So let's keep it a little bit more focused. So if you could look at any sort of legacy process or anything in L&D that you think needs to change, what would you pick?
Form-based feedback. So we understand in L&D, you need to understand how your learners are engaging with the content, whether they like it, whether they thought there were some gaps in it, whether they got what out of it, what you wanted them to get out of it, etc. That's what we do need to get that feedback. We need to iterate and improve our learning that's being deployed to our learners, and that's fine. But the form-based feedback side of it, where you effectively complete your course and then it says, hey, can you spend 5 minutes with us while we ask you a series of questions, which are very prescriptive in terms of what you're trying to get out of it. I mean, when you phone help desks and things like that, and they always say, oh, there's a short survey at the end if you can spare a minute. And I don't know, James, if you're anything like me, but I'm immediately, no, hang it up. I'm not interested. I don't want to know. And they just want to know the same information, but actually getting people to do it is a problem. And the form-based feedback, I mean, I think there's studies show that you're more likely to share bad experiences than good. So even with the best intentions, and your course might be incredible, you're more likely to get more people complaining about it than you are people saying it was great. So the form-based feedback serves a purpose, but it's not the right way. So we're trying to solve this a little bit over at Thirst. But again, in general, I think you should be able to get all this information using technology. You know, you should be able to look at it and say, okay, people seem to spend a lot longer on this screen than beforehand, or they don't know where they're clicking, they seem to click on the wrong bit, or they answer this question quite consistently incorrectly, and that must mean we're not doing a good job of being able to, you know, and, you know, provide that information for them. And it's difficult to do that as a independent person yourself, to look through it, to analyze all that data. But again, lean on the technology, it can sort of give you synopses of all this data, put that together and say, hey, here's where your gaps are, here's where you can improve. There's tools like Microsoft Clarity, which will sort of track whatever the learner is looking at, and this is for web pages as well, but for anything that you're looking at on your web page, where they click, where they went to, do they seem to press this button instead of that button, etc. And you can form a lot of information from that. So slightly more contentious, but just that legacy form-based feedback, I think there's better solutions that we can put in place now.
So I think, you know, your point about form-based feedback is really interesting, because having been in those sort of L&D internal roles at times in my career, it's what are you really trying to do? So is form-based feedback to help you improve the learning experience? Is it to try and justify your existence? Is it, you know, there's lots of things that are underpinning what people are trying to do. So if you step back and go, this is about improving that individual product, so we want to make that learning session, that online course better. Or is this about proving that we've had some value of taking someone out for half an hour a day, whatever it happens to be? And there's lots of things spinning around that. And sometimes it's really stepping back and being able to push back and think, is there a better way of us achieving that top objective? But sometimes we just sort of get in the flow of, this is part of what we do, and we just put one of these at the end and no one really takes them seriously, fill them in. We maybe do some reporting on some happy sheets or whatever else. And it's just part of that legacy of what we're doing. And I've seen a lot of these things in time. And, you know, another challenge for me is selling of content. Sometimes I see content and I'm like, it's just bloated. And I understand why it's bloated, because it's the old, you know, consultancy adage of, I come in, I spend 3 days doing something with you and you feel like you've had value. I come in, I spend 2 minutes with you answering your question and solve that in 2 minutes. Doesn't feel like value, even though the other one is more, you know, less valuable because I've wasted 3 days of your time. It's the same with content. Could you imagine a content library that was like, OK, we're not going to have an hour's course on this, a 20 minute course on that. We've got all these things and we're going to solve it, and we're not going to waste multiple periods of your staff's time. No one needs to know about the health and safety at work at 974. Not really, only if they're passing an exam. It's not relevant. We still put it in there. But to me, if you think about the amount of time, and having worked in really big businesses, 30,000 people's time by an extra 15 minutes is actually a hell of a lot of resource wasted. But we don't think in that mindset. We just blindly walk through these things, you know, so that it, to me, there's a whole, if you step back and look at so many of the things we do, they are fundamentally flawed, because maybe, you know, again, I've been there. I've been at the point where bringing someone out of the workplace into a classroom for a day, you almost had to throw as much knowledge at them as you could, because that was your one opportunity of the year. Now, some of that reason for us doing things in that way has still stuck in the way that we do learning today. And I think that, to me, is why we don't change, because we don't really question some of the things that we do in the industry that are maybe driven out of necessity at the time, or because that was the only solution. But now the world or technology or other things have meant we can break a lot of things and do things in really creative ways.
Yeah, well, the form-based feedback is a perfect example of it. It almost doesn't get questioned. It's too obvious. But actually, when you think about it, you think, actually, this isn't the best way of doing it. And you touch upon a good point, I think, as well, in terms of what we can do with technology doesn't have to always be end user facing as well. It doesn't have to always be directly for that learner to give them that personalization or whatever else associated with it. You talked about the cost of time of delivering that learning content, and effectively when you multiply that out by the number of employees for a business, it's a very costly exercise. And there's, I think it was Shopify recently, I think they've added a little plugin for their Google Calendar, which multiplies a set amount of the time of the meeting by the amount of people on the meeting and their cost to their average salary, and says that this meeting actually costs you whatever it'll cost, like $8,000 or something like that. And it makes you aware that you think, actually, maybe if we don't have this meeting, this will actually save us the time. And that's really simple technology. It's just a multiplication and a plugin. There's nothing too much crazy to it. But the impact that has to your business, I think, is phenomenal, because it just allows you to just rethink about how you're approaching it and look for optimal cost savings. So maybe there's a way, you know, technology L&D can actually assist potentially sort of streamlining that thought process and stakeholders, and not necessarily just directly for the end learner.
No, and I think that's, you know, it's having that mindset, though, because the meeting one is a great one. I've sat in sort of senior management teams, and like after 10 minutes, I've been the person who's gone, right, we must be, you know, round this table, have spurned up this amount of salary trying to save, you know, £1,000 worth of value to the business. You just, again, people sometimes get stuck, and it's human nature, but it's using those tools to break some of those, like you said, with that, you know, the bit of tech showing, actually, this is how much this meeting is costing. Are you getting, and that becoming part of the way that you operate starts to make you question things. This is how much this learning course is going to cost. Is that eliminating this amount of risk or adding that amount of value or whatever it happens to be? It starts to just get you thinking in a different way. And it's not from a way of cutting everything, but spending your time more effectively, spending your value and resource more effectively. People almost have this inherent thing that as soon as you start questioning those things, you're going to cut things, you know, cut learning, cut not. It's more about saying, where can, you know, a day's time spent doing something differently of, you know, shadowing a different function, going out and seeing something external, going and working elsewhere, can be far more valuable than, you know, a day of clicking and consuming content, which might then tick through to my paper PDF certificate that I can then take back and show on my CPD for my industry, which is still working on an input rather than an output measure of learning. But again, those fundamental thought processes are broken. Therefore, the solutions are going to fix the old problem of, you know, my CPD target for the year is 50 hours of learning. That's set often by regulation or legislation. So therefore, that drives us just to do some hours. And it doesn't actually say, you know, what's usable, what's that 50 hours of value. So again, there's lots of things, I think, that sometimes drive the solutions to not solve the business problems, because we haven't solved the thinking problems. And don't know if that makes any sense, but that's where I see a lot of the challenges.
Yeah, I think the ways technology can help here is it can move us along slowly and sort of start to form a new way of thinking. But I think it's going to take time ultimately. You know, the amount of times I still see learning platform engagement tracked by simply how many logins they've had, and they say, okay, we've had 10 or 100 or 1,000 this week, and then so we've had, you know, 1,500 next week. That means it's great, it's going better. But actually, they don't sort of dig into that any further and say, well, actually, no one's actually completing any courses now, or no one's, they're just logging in because they've been told to log in that week via an email, and they don't track that through. I think we can use a lot of guidance from marketing divisions. I think it's really smart when you think about marketing will track engagements in terms of there's a social post going out there, but they don't just track, you know, it was seen by 1,000 people in the same way L&D might track logins. They track, well, who clicked it, but then who clicked it, who actually filled in the form, and then from the people who filled in the form, you know, they continue to revisit our site afterwards, and they're constantly analyzing that. So I think the more tools that we can use technology to assist L&D to make that, I think we can provide that value back to the stakeholders, and over time the stakeholders, you know, mindset of this will shift a little bit and start to utilize these extra bits of information and try and analyze it, and hopefully we'll just get away from that simplistic metric that tries to prove out engagement.
Yeah, I think that data stuff's really important, because if you think about, you know, the causation and correlation of performance, so if you can start to see where performance is working, what that people are doing, you know, where either learning or other processes are being impacted. You know, if you think back to the call center you mentioned earlier, you get, you know, the call at the end, but you can start to see, you know, who, which learning is impacting upon service is impacting upon things as we go through. And often these data points are in different silos across the business, and it's or what are the challenges that people are having? Or again, for me, seemingly it's sometimes not even a training issue. It's a process issue, because, you know, I'm phoning up organizations who are unable to solve my query on a first time basis because of gaps in their performance and process. And I'm, you know, I have numerous organizations on my hate dealing with list because they're not using that data to be able to solve simple customer problems. And, you know, I think in the same way that we're providing a service. So how are we using the data available to us to help our customers get to where they need to be better in terms of learners, to learn things, to impact performance, to, you know, what's helping people progress, what's helping people, you know, engagement figures. Again, there's all sorts of data out there that can help us understand things better, and having to do it on an old, you know, go and search, extract, put it all together. So the big data bit, I think, is going to be really interesting if people get curious about what they can learn, what they can solve, and what they can help replicate.
It will assist in enhancing the focus of what L&D solves into that wider business strategy, because I still think in many cases L&D is foreseen by certain stakeholders as being sort of a means to an end. It's a, you know, ticking a box for compliance. It's okay, we've done that, that's great. We know we're not at risk of our insurances being void because we've got evidence of this happening or something like that. And I always want to flip the script a little bit and say, well, how can it help us? So, you know, can it identify a skill that we have in the business that we didn't realize we had, or a need for something that the teams are calling out for that we didn't realize? And then that might even transform into a new product line, for instance, that you can start to sell what you didn't even realize, because you had that, you know, especially if you're a services business, you might realize someone's got, you know, database analytics or something like that as a skill that we have, and there's more people than you thought in the business, there might be an added value. I want to think about L&D as being able to benefit that wider business plan rather than just a means to an end to tick a box for compliance.
So Fred, we've talked a lot about lots of different things and things that might be able to be better, and some of the legacies around the industry and tech we maybe should be able to bin off, or approaches we should be able to bin off. But looking forward, how should, you know, people approach new technology as it's coming along? Because obviously we've got high profile stuff like generative AI and other things that people are talking about. People have talked about VR, AR in the past. But if a team are thinking about new technology coming in, how should they approach it?
Well, we should obviously look to embrace it, because that's how we do get ahead. But I think there's a caveat to this, and we've touched upon it already, but it is that scenario of we're an outcomes-based industry and sector. That's all we are. So you've got to always map that back and say, does it provide that value or not? How is it going to improve even my life as, you know, as L&D manager, or my stakeholders, or my learners? You know, what benefit and value is it give us? I think you have to step away from the FOMO a little bit and bear in mind what the objectives and outcomes effectively are. And I think you just have to consistently ask who it's benefiting, but also be aware of the dangers it potentially brings as well, especially when we talk about AI. You know, there is certain scenarios where it can add bias to things as well. It can, depending on how it goes, it can actually start to give you wrong information. So you've got to be aware of that. But ultimately, I think the technologies, we should just continue to play around with it. I think oddly, the L&D space generally is a little bit behind, seemingly. It always seems to be playing catch up. But I think this is its biggest advantage in this case, because we actually get to analyze what's out there correctly over time, and then slowly and then bring it in rather than rush into it like a lot of the other software as a service solutions are doing and products that are out there at the moment. So I think we should take our time with it, and but still embrace it. The only other thing I think I've got is, you know, that some technologies are there and are already relatively vetted as being beneficial. And we have good examples and use cases. We talked about personalization being a perfect one. And you can start to put things in place now already that will benefit from that, and then start to roll out things like personalization to your organization. So, you know, it's not just a magic switch overnight. You're not going to be able to turn that on and suddenly, you know, you're using that new technology and everyone's benefiting. You've got to structure your learning content to be able to benefit from personalization. You've got to break that up into smaller chunks, so then ultimately you can deliver it in different pathways and utilize that. If it's all just one big course, you know, that's 8 hours long or something similar, that's not going to be able to be broken up and won't benefit from personalization. So we can start to look to use a technology that's already been relatively vetted as successful, start to make preparations in support of that, and then just keep our mind, I think, on the technologies that moves forward, and just always have, you know, outcomes and objectives in our mind, really, and who it's benefiting.
So lots of good stuff there about thinking about the individual technologies, you know, working out what works, what's not, having the use case. What are your hopes for the future of the industry?
Well, I want us to, I do want us to catch up a little bit, even though my counter argument was just that, you know, being a little bit slow in L&D is our benefit in terms of this AI technology sort of driven focus. But I think as a sector, it does frustrate me. I think everybody has sat there in their life and been told to do a compliance mandatory training page turner about, you know, the right way to position a ladder against the wall, and it drives you mad as a learner, and we still regurgitating that thing. So I think we have to think about how our learners are, in, you know, interacting with the world, really. You know, they're used to the Netflix instant, always on, you know, getting the information they need and getting it in a small segments. So I think we do have to catch up in general. I want to see us use the technology we have, but I think my primary focus would be to use it to benefit the L&D manager's time and being able to optimize. We talked earlier on about the job description, about how you can utilize like ChatGPT to give you a list of the key responsibilities of a job role. That was a perfect example for me of how we can just utilize the tools that are already there. We don't have any problems around biases or the incorrect factual information. We don't have any sort of arguments around that, but you can use it as a real time saver. And I think we should be thinking in that mindset initially, because it's a much easier way to say, well, this is a repetitive job. You know, big data, we talked about, how can we get statistics out that are a bit more accurate, a bit faster? How can we look at gaps in our learning that are there without us sat through, you know, thousands of completion data and try and track that data? I think we can use the technology to progress the future of the industry in that way. And then, yeah, the final one, and I think it's right at the start, less acronyms. I would love less acronyms for our industry. You know, we've got there's a page on them, LXPs, EXPs, LMSs, and everything else associated with it. And even SCORM, I still feel like I still quote what it actually stands for incorrectly, even to this day. I just don't think it helps sell our sector very well. I don't think it helps when people are coming to purchase, because they don't know what they're buying and they don't know the difference between these platforms. And in many ways, there aren't that many differences between a lot of them. They do all sort of generally sort of revert to the mean. And I think that would be a nice thing we could all collectively do. I noticed there's a shift in us moving on towards using learning platform as a word rather than LMS or LXP. I think that's the way people are going, which I quite like. But I think we've got quite a bit of work to do, you know, catching up and standardizing a little bit. But I have a lot of hopes for it. I think we're certainly progressing and looking to do the right things, I think, in general.
No, I think that's a nice positive message to end on. And yes, if we could kill the acronyms, I absolutely agree with you, because to me, a lot of them were just marketing gimmicks to try and make people stand out from something else, when if you looked under the covers, they were pretty much the same thing anyway, or there was no real difference between a lot of them. But let's leave all that in the past. And I'd really like to thank you for joining us today. I think we've covered lots of stuff, and hopefully it's prompted some maybe reflections on things people can do differently, but also some hope and drive and some tips to move forward into the future. And if people want to connect with you and stay in touch and follow your thoughts and find out a bit more about you and your company, what should they do?
You can get in touch with me on LinkedIn. I'm generally relatively active on there, and also fredthompson.co.uk, where I occasionally blog about things as well. But thirst.io, thirst.io is the company that we've been talking a little bit about today. So yeah, any of them channels, just please get in touch. I'd be happy to talk about these things in further detail. I find them oddly interesting, and I can certainly talk about technology for a long, long time, being in my background. So yeah, I can bore many people for a while on that one.
Brilliant. Thanks, Fred. And we'll make sure that all of those links are in the show notes below the podcast. Thank you for joining us today.
Excellent. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Learning Reinvented podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you've not already done so, please follow our podcast. And if The Learning Effect can help you and your organisation, please do get in touch. You can find both James and Katie on LinkedIn, and our contact details are in the show notes below.